Tuesday, October 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, 2 weeks to go before the U.S. presidential election as Americans continue to show deep divides over the pandemic.
The Trump administration's response to the pandemic has become a partisan issue, with Republicans opposing strict economic lockdowns to contain the virus and emphasizing the rights of the individual.
The coronavirus is disproportionately impacting migrants around the world.
We need to avoid rolling back on integration. We need to reaffirm that migration is an integral part of our reality, of our lives.
Also ahead, the late guitar great Eddie Van Halen's electric guitars going up for auction. It's all on today's International Edition. The world surpassed 40 million COVID-19 cases as of Thursday. Infections have been reported in more than 210 countries and territories since the first cases were identified in China in December of 2019. The United States continues to have a surge of infections, with 38 states seeing a rise in the last 2 weeks. The nation's top infectious disease specialist, Dr. Anthony Fauci, in an interview with CBS's 60 Minutes on Sunday, expressed deep concern for the upcoming winter months.
There are now about 40 million cases globally and over 1,100,000 deaths. The United States has been the most severely hit of all the countries in the world, again with about 8 million cases and now closing in on 218,000 deaths.
Meanwhile, America's handling of the coronavirus pandemic is an issue that could decide the upcoming U.S. presidential election, as it's taken center stage over ideological fights that dominated past elections. VOA's Brian Padden reports.
At a recent rally with senior citizens in Florida, President Donald Trump again said the end of the coronavirus pandemic is near and the development of a vaccine close at hand.
My message to America's seniors today is one of optimism, confidence, and hope. Your sacrifice has not been in vain. The light at the end of the tunnel is near. We are rounding the turn.
Democratic rival Joe Biden continues to charge the president is downplaying the pandemic as U.S. COVID cases rise.
Turn the corner. My Lord, it's not disappearing. In fact, it's on the rise again.
The pandemic has caused 220 deaths in the U.S., according to Johns Hopkins University, as well as an economic recession and to some degree displaced traditional ideological issues that dominated past elections. Experts say free trade, immigration, health care, climate change, abortion rights, and gun control have all been overshadowed by the pandemic.
Those have been supplanted in part by COVID-19. It still exists. But this is like a new issue that didn't exist before, and now is one of the leading issues that defines where the candidates are and how people vote.
The Trump administration's response to the pandemic has become a partisan issue, with Republicans opposing strict economic lockdowns to contain the virus and emphasizing the rights of the individual over mandates to wear masks and social distance.
Well, there's discussions around masks, or discussions around the level in which the government should be or shouldn't be involved in public safety or in other elements of our lives. But we're seeing that play out right now.
By contrast, Biden and Democrats urge collective responsibility to bring down the infection rate and allow normal business activity to resume. With a significant lead in presidential polls, Biden remains focused on making the election a referendum on Trump's handling of the pandemic. While the Trump campaign highlights America's robust pre-pandemic economy and promises a swift recovery after the pandemic ends. Brian Padden, VOA News, Washington.
Well, there's still a lot we don't know about COVID-19, but scientists and medical experts are learning more and more as the pandemic continues. Joining us for clarification on some of the confusing issues that many people feel uncertain about is Dr. Rajesh Gandhi, infectious disease physician at Harvard Medical School and a member of the National Institutes of Health COVID-19 Treatment Guidelines Panel, as well as the Infectious Diseases Society of America. Thank you for being with us. U.S. doctor. So one thing that's still confusing is at what point after you've been in contact with someone who has COVID-19, can you be confident that you have not been infected?
I think what the CDC has generally recommended is that the people at greatest risk are people who are exposed for more than 15 minutes and within 6 feet of a person without a mask. And so there's gradations of risk, and that's what the CDC feels like the risk is the greatest.
What if people have already tested negative? Should they just forget that rule, or should they continue to be very careful for a couple of weeks?
It's an excellent question. A single negative test, depending on when it's taken, doesn't necessarily rule out that someone will turn positive later. So a lot depends on when the test is taken and when the last exposure is and how close the exposure is. So it's a fair point to say that if you're tested very, very early, let's say a day or so after exposure, you may not yet have built up a viral level high enough for the test to turn positive. So repeat testing for close exposures, people who have been, you know, within 6 feet without a mask for 15 minutes or more, is definitely advisable. That kind of serial testing really is important.
Do we know enough about this virus to know that even someone who may get sick from it, even very sick, and then recovers, at what point they're no longer able to spread it? Do we have that kind of information?
You know, we now do have that kind of information. We didn't early on. Back in February and March, there was a lot of question about this. But over time, as contact tracing and more and more knowledge have been acquired, we have a good answer for that, which is that for almost everyone with COVID-19, that if within about 10 days of their symptom onset, the beginning of the symptoms, if their symptoms are decreasing and they no longer have a fever, they're no longer infectious. So when the CDC talks about people who've had an infection, they say that isolation can be lifted when it's been 10 days since the beginning of the symptoms and when the symptoms have started to improve. They also add that you should have no fever and you shouldn't be taking any fever-reducing medicines for at least a day. So that's information that back in February and March we were all wondering, but I'm quite confident that the data is quite strong for that kind of recommendation.
And what about if you've had it once and recovered? Do we know yet if it is possible that you can still get it again?
Excellent question. In recent weeks, not months, but weeks, we've started to hear cases of reinfection. The first of these cases was reported out of Hong Kong. The way you know if someone is reinfected is you have to have a sample from the first infection and a sample from the second infection. You need to compare them to make sure that they're genetically different, that the sequence is different. That's the only way you can be absolutely sure that the virus the second time around is different than the first time around, and that's really the definition of a reinfection. Since that first report out of Hong Kong, there have been several other reports of reinfection, so we know that it can happen. There's been tens of millions of people who've had COVID-19, so we believe reinfection is uncommon, but we're literally learning more on an everyday basis. That is, every day we learn more than we did the day before about reinfection, so it can happen. I don't believe it's very frequent. And as to why some people can get it again and most people seem to not get it again, I think we still need to figure that out. People are trying to figure out if there's differences in immunity or something else about the viral inoculum or how much virus you're exposed to. So stay tuned. That's something the scientific community is very much focused on trying to answer.
Dr. Rajesh Gandhi, infectious disease physician at Harvard Medical School and a member of the National Institutes of Health COVID-19 Treatment Guidelines Panel. Well, the coronavirus pandemic has undoubtedly changed the lives of most people across the globe. But a new report reveals that it has had a particularly negative impact on migrants around the world. Angel Gurria, Secretary General of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, talked about the report's findings at a virtual news conference in Paris on Monday.
Now, the COVID-19 pandemic has redrawn the international migration map. The closure of national borders as well as entry bans were amongst the first measures put in place.
And joining us now for more on what this report said is Paris-based journalist Catherine Field. So Catherine, let's just start with what the report revealed.
This report highlights areas where migrants living in the 37 member countries of the OECD have suffered disproportionately. One area, labor market. The unemployment rate for migrants has risen in countries such as Canada, the US, and Norway. And now migrants make up around 60% of those without a job because of the effects on the economy of the coronavirus. Take a look at sectors particularly hard hit in economic downturn, such as hospitality and tourism, where many migrants had found work, but they were on temporary contracts, which were ended with little or no notice period. Another area the report highlights, migrants are likely to suffer double the number of COVID cases as they work in areas where they're more likely to be exposed to the risk of contracting the virus, but also because they tend to live in poor housing conditions. So with job losses, lockdowns, and work-from-home orders, these migrants are therefore likely to be more isolated, unable to attend classes to improve their language skills and job training, and that in turn affects their chances of integrating into society.
So, Catherine, the report highlighted migrant families, children, of course, a large portion of those impacted, their relatives. Why was that?
Several aspects highlighting effects on the wider family. The first being that when schools closed due to COVID, the children risk losing touch with the wider community. And even if there are online classes, poorer migrant families do not necessarily have the ability to purchase computers needed for their children to follow distance learning. Then you have the remittances. If people are losing their jobs, then they're unable to send financial remittances back home. At the moment, many do receive state benefits, but these are not as generous as wages and may not continue indefinitely. Then there's the question of visas for family members. Many governments have closed their borders and in some cases halted applications for entry. I mean, look at the figures. Look at the number of figures for visas and permits that have been issued. It's around half of what they were this time last year.
Was there anything positive that we can take away from the report? Any good news come out of it at all?
Indeed, there was. Foreign-born workers have contributed in areas that continued operating during lockdowns, despite risks to their health. In particular, it was highlighted essential services such as transport, cleaning, food manufacturing, and security relied on foreign-born workers. An important area was healthcare, and the figures there show that 1 in 4 medical doctors and 1 in 6 nurses in the OECD member countries were foreign-born, and they played a crucial role in keeping the health services operating.
Paris-based reporter Catherine Field, thanks as always. African diaspora organizers say the U.S. 2020 election is drawing more African-born immigrants eligible to vote, but some argue that they're not organized enough to constitute a voting bloc relative to other immigrant communities in the U.S. VOA's Solomon Solomon reports.
The African diaspora in the United States is mobilizing voter drives as organizers believe 2020 is a time for these voters to flex their political muscles as never before. Nika Achapu is the founder of the African Public Affairs Committee, a nonpartisan political organization that advocates policies for the empowerment of the African diaspora.
Our goal is to empower people into learning that they have a voice, they have a say in the policies, in the laws that are actually brought forth and are affecting us as Africans living in this country.
According to the latest U.S. Census figures, in 2018, there were over 2 million foreign-born Africans in the country. Overall, 50.6% of immigrants are naturalized citizens and 94.4% are 18 years old or older and likely have voting rights. But the diverse and dispersed nature of the population in the U.S. makes it hard for African voters to organize, although there are concentrated population centers in several cities, including Minneapolis, Washington, D.C., Houston, and New York City, the African diaspora does not speak with a single voice. There are no definitive surveys as to the political leanings of African diaspora, says John Campbell, a senior fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, D.C.
They are not big enough or organized enough to constitute a voting bloc, unlike some other ethnic identities in the United States.
But organizers say concerns of U.S. voters of African descent aren't much different than the U.S. population at large, the economy, education, healthcare, and security. Because many African immigrants work in frontline roles, the COVID-19 response is a major concern.
A lot of our African diaspora members are in the trenches and working, whether it's in the medical field, whether it's in transporting people, whether it's bagging groceries. We are pretty much everywhere.
And the power of voters from the African diaspora appears to be growing. Between 2010 and 2018, the sub-Saharan Africa population in the U.S. increased by 52%. On a national level, several African politicians have made waves. In 2018, Representative Ilhan Omar of Minnesota became the first Somali-American elected to Congress, and Representative Joe Neguse of Colorado, born in the U.S. to Eritrean parents, became the first person of Eritrean origin elected to Congress. A study by the Pew Research Center showed that, contrary to stereotypes, African immigrants to the U.S. on average are more likely to be college educated and employed than the population at large.
I think that it's very hard to pigeonhole them, that like Americans in general, they will vote for whichever candidate personally appeals to them the most.
But one issue voters of African descent are particularly concerned about is immigration, organizers say. Many came as immigrants or have family members that have immigrated to the country. Each year, tens of thousands of Africans are admitted to the U.S. as refugees, escaping places like the Democratic Republic of Congo, Somalia, and Eritrea. Because of this, Africans are particularly concerned with recent changes to the immigration system restricting numbers of immigrants. In 2016, the U.S. admitted nearly 85,000 refugees, including 31,000 from Africa. In 2020, the U.S. will admit a total of 18,000 refugees and 15,000 in 2021. The U.S. State Department says the reduction reaffirms America's enduring commitment to assist the world's most vulnerable people while fulfilling our first duty to protect and serve the American people. Sam Fanti, a Washington, D.C.-based political strategist who's organizing a voter drive in Georgia and Kentucky to register immigrant citizens, said recent U.S. policies, like a travel ban that has cut off immigrant visas to several African countries and highly publicized deportations of Africans, are galvanizing voters.
Many African families have been here for two, three, four, or even more generations. So they feel like their children and their children's children need to be protected now. And so they are now galvanizing support from one another in their communities to register to vote in order to defeat and change some of those policies now.
The immigration issue is making African diaspora voters more active and outspoken than in recent memory, Fanti says.
If we are in this country and we are paying taxes, we need to vote and we need to do something when it comes to some of these policies that are directly now affecting them.
Salem Solomon, VOA News, Washington.
The United Nations is set to hold a major donor conference today for Africa's violence-hit Sahel region. For more, my colleague Jason Fatinkin spoke to VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir in New York.
This conference is focused on the Sahel, particularly Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso, where about 14 million people are in need of urgent assistance. And that was 4 million more than the UN estimated at the beginning of this year would need help. And half of them are children. The UN is warning that the Sahel is facing basically a perfect storm of factors that are pushing the region deeper into poverty, to hunger, and into the hands of extremists. And they're saying that if the international community does not invest the attention and the money to stop it now, the consequences could spread beyond the region in the coming years. And it's sort of one of these crises that everyone knows is happening, but not enough is being done to get it in hand. David Beasley, who's the head of the World Food Program, warned on Friday that there's two provinces in Burkina Faso where about 11,000 people live, and they're concerned that they're on the brink of famine in that area. So what they're hoping to do Tuesday at this conference, which is being convened with Germany, Denmark, the European Union, and the UN, they're hoping to hit targets of hundreds of millions of dollars.
And where would all this money go?
So the money is going to be dispersed among several agencies at the UN that handle humanitarian efforts. For instance, the World Food Program, UNICEF, which helps children, but primarily to these humanitarian programs and the Office of Humanitarian Affairs, because they hand out the funds to keep these programs going. Some places, rations have been cut due to funding cuts, you know, so they just want to get people back up to their basic calorie intake of the day and to make sure that they have some medical services available to them. So they really just need to take care of basic needs.
Now, this comes at a time when the UN is really struggling for donations. Is that correct?
There's so many crises right now in the world, and we have COVID on top of it. So you have donor fatigue. You have the richest countries in the world making huge stimulus packages in their own countries. So they're not as keen, perhaps, to give money to other countries right now for development assistance or humanitarian assistance as they normally would. The UN is struggling on many fronts, not just in the Sahel, but basically, across the board, its humanitarian programs are struggling and facing funding gaps this year. But in the bigger picture, you know, the humanitarian aid is fixing the short-term problems. But the UN and its partners are saying we really need to look at the long-term and how we're going to fix some of these underlying causes. And we need to get a sustained commitment from the international community to be a partner to the Sahel and to help them.
VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir speaking with my colleague Jason Patinkin. China appears to have escalated a trade dispute with Australia. The cotton industry has said Chinese mills are being told not to process Australian imports. It follows restrictions in China on Australian coal and other agricultural commodities. Phil Mercer has more from Sydney.
Australia's cotton industry is worth about $565 million annually. China is by far its biggest customer, but there are concerns cotton growers are the latest victims of a simmering trade war. Chinese mills have reportedly been told not to buy Australian cotton, and industry representatives fear that exports to China could face Beijing-imposed tariffs as high as 40%, which would likely make the trade unviable. To add to the frustration, cotton producers are beginning to plant for what is forecast to be a large crop after a long drought in Australia. Adam Kay is the chief executive of Cotton Australia, a leading trade organisation. He believes the ban on Australian imports into China is widespread.
Most of the mills we've spoken to have been impacted. So, you know, it is concerning for us because something like 65% of our Australian crop does go to China at the moment. And it's been a really mutually beneficial relationship, and to have that jeopardised is a real worry.
The Australian government is urgently trying to clarify the situation, although government ministers have said extracting information from their Chinese counterparts is hard. Bilateral ties have soured in recent years. In 2017, Australian intelligence agents warned of growing Chinese attempts to influence Australian domestic politics. A year later, Australia bans the Chinese technology company Huawei from its 5G telecommunications network because of national security fears. This year, Australia's call for a global investigation into the origins of the new coronavirus, which was first detected in China, provoked more anger from Beijing. No one is quite sure where all this leaves Australia's relationship with its biggest trading partner, but the trade disputes appear to be intensifying. China has reportedly banned some imports of Australian coal and has imposed restrictions on barley and meat and launched an anti-dumping investigation into Australian wine imports. China has also warned students and tourists not to visit Australia because of allegations of racism. Beijing has also been agitated by Canberra's close military ties with the United States. And analysts have said Australia needs deft and delicate diplomacy to protect its pivotal trading relationship with China. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
David DeRoche, associate professor at the U.S. National Defense University, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy. A new ceasefire in the mountain enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh was in jeopardy on Monday, with Azerbaijan and ethnic Armenian forces reporting shelling and heavy fighting in some areas. Azerbaijan said it had neutralized a missile fired by Armenian forces at an oil pipeline in Azerbaijan on Sunday, just hours after the ceasefire went into force. Armenia denied the accusation. You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
We are always glad to have our listeners throughout Africa tuning in to our newscast covering Africa news. Tune in on the top of each hour 24/7. VOA is your trusted source of news and information.
They're still trying to figure out what are the specific policies from the White House.
VOA Asia, your daily digest of top Asia stories.
Beijing has especially hazardous levels of air pollution.
Blending American and Asian perspectives.
China is protecting wildlife.
Original reports and series, education, health, technology. Stories that mean something to your daily life. VOA Asia.
VOA's International Edition continues.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA's OSIRIS-REx spacecraft has been orbiting and making observations of the asteroid Bennu since 2018. One of the most important aspects of the mission is a maneuver called touch and go, or tag. That's when the spacecraft will be sent to the surface of the asteroid so that it can scoop up at least 60 grams of material that will be sent back to Earth for study. The capsule containing the samples is expected to reach Earth in 2023. Scientists theorize that Bennu contains substances that date back to the early days of the solar system and compounds that may have triggered life on Earth. The tag maneuver is scheduled to take place at 10 hours and 12 minutes UTC on October 20th. At its equator, Bennu has a radius of about 282 meters and is approximately 331 million kilometers from Earth. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Two guitars owned, played, and partly designed by the late Eddie Van Halen will be going up for auction. Both electric guitars will be on sale at the Beverly Hills auction starting December 5th. Each instrument is expected to fetch between $60,000 and $80,000. The auction was already in the works when the guitar legend and Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee died of cancer on October 6th at the age of 65. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thanks so much for listening.